Welcome to episode 14 of A Legitimate Salvage, a podcast about The Expanse in which four friends and Doctor Who fans attempt to rewatch seasons 1 through 3 before season 4 premieres on Amazon in December. Let's go around and introduce ourselves before we launch into the discussion of episodes 4 and 5 of the third season, Reload and Triple Point.
I'm Jen Burt.
I'm Katie Burt.
I'm Warren Fry.
And I am Chip Sutterith. So pretty eventful episodes in this one. We'll talk about the impact of them when we go into spoiler space later on, but some quick reactions on these two episodes in which the Rossi is getting increasingly full of people.
Crowded TARDIS.
It's getting a little clogged, frankly.
I know. I was saying to Jen that even, like, it's so good, though, because I care about all of the characters who are on it so much. Even the newer ones, to be honest. Or there's enough people on the ship that I always care what's happening, even when plot-wise, nothing important is actually really happening.
You even care about Ensign Sinipoli?
Yep.
Who? Wait a minute. Who's that? Is that one of the Martians?
There were so many people that were introduced this episode that I just started calling, like, underling, random Martian. I was like, what are any of their names?
Baby-faced Martian.
Some of them I care about. Nice. Some of them I didn't care about.
Growly Martian, baby-faced Martian, choked Martian.
Yeah.
Does that guy die? Because it seems like he dies.
Choked Martian? I think he...
Yeah, the choked guy.
I think choked Martian makes it.
Okay, cool.
It does... That is a pretty intense choking scene, though.
Yeah, and...
Holden really is... Yeah.
Props for CGI on the rapidly bleeding face of Holden after he gets punched a few times. And that was the most important part, clearly, of these two episodes. Let's do the clever episode synopses, and then let's dive into Reload and Triple Point.
First off, we have Reload, which originally aired on May 2nd, 2018. In one of the most clever, awe-inspiring, hard sci-fi spacey sequences in Expanse history, Drummer and a fleet of drones catch up to, reverse, and commandeer the Nauvoo. We don't think it's going to be a Generation Explorer ship anymore. So, now that we've done the spacey sequence, let's do the talkie sequences. Alex recommends, but is still squicked by the idea of salvaging fuel and ammo from the wrecked Martian ships on the way to Io, which flips Bobby out. Christian gripes with Bobby that she needs to tell Admiral Souther what's going on and barely convinces Holden to arrange a tight beam transmission. Prax is developing his grim resolve as he watches a video of Dr. Strickland selling protomolecule hybrids to the highest bidder. And Secretary General Gillis starts giving Anna's speech to the General Assembly, then pivots to Jack Cole as he adds Aaron Wright's words, turning her call to unity into a call to subjugate Mars. It's hard to tell who Anna's mad at. Holden's team starts salvaging the Martian ship. But wait, someone's sending out an SOS. Action time! They find three Martian soldiers who are real happy to be in the Rossi's Martian sickbay until they realize it's a legitimate salvage. They question its legitimacy, overpower Alex, and try to take the ship. It turns into a standoff until Bobby, the Martian ex-marine who could wipe the floor with all of them, reasons/intimidates them into surrender. Holden introduces Ensign Babyface Martian to the deputy undersecretary of his most hated enemy's government, and they send them away on a repaired ship with a copy of Aaron Wright's incriminating message. Everything ends happy. Bobby and Alex are getting along better now that she's come to terms with her break with the military. Naomi and Holden seem like they're beginning to reconcile, and Prax's daughter May gets to see her friend Katoa again. Wait, did I say happy? Because Katoa is rapidly transforming into a hybrid, has rapidly disassembled his nurse, and is communicating with the protomolecule on Venus. Remember when Jules-Pierre Mao had a moment of conscience and shut down the program? Yeah, that was before Strickland hit the jackpot. The program's back on.
She's the key to everything.
And next we have Triple Point, which aired on May 9th, 2018. While the Rossi tries to bypass the Martian and UNN fleets to get back to Io, the universe's most tedious intern brings his story to the MCRN Hammurabi. Admiral Quirino is skeptical, but there's something going on in Io, and leaves a planet attack at Callisto. She's not the only one. Admiral Wynn, that jerk, also redirects for Ido. We know why. And when Souther objects to Wynn, he kicks him off the bridge. His officers are already thinking mutiny, which Souther is having none of. For now. Meanwhile, the Rossi crew prepares. Christian tells Holden that they need to keep the protomolecule, not nuke it, to develop a defense for Earth, Mars, and the Belt against its alien source. Alex gets a bittersweet message from his son, and as Prax practices shooting, Amos realizes that Prax is becoming kind of Amos-like. James and Naomi continue to reconcile. Then the fit hits the Shan. Mars Admiral Carino sends Ehrenreich's tapes to Earth's Admiral Souther. He confirms the content with Kotiar before being intercepted by Wynn's crew. There's a standoff on the bridge as the Hammurabi approaches, which ends with Souther relieving Wynn of command. He announces an open line back to all the ships that he'll transmit proof that this is an illegal war. But Wynn's men fight back, and all of our favorite people get killed. Wynn fires on a departing UNN ship, and the Earth's fleet start tearing itself apart while Mars watches. And the protomolecule is taking Katoa over faster and faster as he keeps babbling about the work. The protomolecule is completing. They can't use him anymore. The next candidate is May. Father of the Year, Jules Pierre's Mao, tells Strickland to do it. Finally, the Rossi lands on Io to hunt for May, and they start to break into the station, only to see a bunch of strange pods launched into space. Holden intuits, somehow, what we learn in dialogue between Mao and Wynn. Wynn has been given launch code for the protomolecule hybrid pods, and stuff is about to go down. Cliffhanger.
Kind of plot-heavy, huh? I think I wrote these clever episode synopses, and if those of you are still with us after these 2 hours, apologies, but there was a lot of stuff to cover.
So much happened.
I know, but even listening / reading those descriptions, I was like, riveted. So much does happen. I'm into all of it.
We like The Expanse because of characters, but the plot isn't anything to sniff at either.
Well, they chew through story. I've said it before. They just chew through story like there's no tomorrow.
Yeah, and it shows how strong the plot is when you can introduce these characters that are around for 1 to 3 episodes at a time. And not always, but a lot of times you end up caring what happens to them. And that's a strength of the plot, I think, that they can imbue the character with meaning when you don't actually have time to develop those characters.
Sure, like the Admiral and the Captain on the MCRN Hammurabi. We don't see a whole lot of them in Triple Point, but they come across as reasonably well-rounded characters with just a few just a few lines. They've got a reason to be, and they sort of seem to have motivations for how they react to Inns and Babyface's news.
And I'm inclined to distrust one of them because he's a Cylon. So,
well, that's fair.
But even despite that, they're the two of them trying to make decisions. I feel like what's her name? Carino. Yeah. I don't know her name, but she goes through a whole thought process, it seems, of what to do with those messages or that message. And I buy it, even though I don't know her, and it is only over a very brief time.
Yeah, she was properly skeptical of being handed this stuff on a silver platter in a way that Innocent Babyface just can't be. You know, he's just gobsmacked by everything that's happened to him. But she comes around once she's, you know, she apparently decides that she's going to test the information, so...
I think it helps, too, that thinking back, we have seen other Martian commanders who are very reasoned and wise before.
Oh, God rest his soul, Bobby Seo.
Yeah, who I think his name is Sutton, but I always called him Button, in my head at least. And then even in the first season, the ship that the Rossi crew or the survivors of the Canterbury end up on. Yeah, the Tachi. That commander was a little maybe arrogant, and I think that obviously worked against her, but she wasn't bad at her job. She could have done a better job, obviously, but given the information she had, I think she made good decisions, and she's interested in listening to Holden in that moment. So having that history of, you know, level-headed Martian commanders, I think really helps us buy and immediately get on board with this new character.
And on the other side of the conflict, we certainly see a wide disparity in attitudes and approaches with the UNN brass. I mean, we get a genuine mutiny, a genuine shooting war between Earth ships after Admiral Souther gets killed. It's a really nuanced depiction of the military that you don't always get in a lot of genre storytelling, and I'm wondering if any of y'all were surprised by that.
This is a much more military show than most in some ways, and even the Belters, who aren't really a formal military, they're kind of like Wild West quasi-formal military guys. They have to be mercenaries in a way, so it's just a variation on a theme. So it doesn't surprise me that there's a lot more here. Plus, who would be flying out first? And Mars is essentially a military colony, right? So, or not colony, mm-hmm. It's its own thing. And that's kind of why I think Mars has some more nuance to its characters, because it is the better military society. Much like Starship Troopers, this is what's important to them. So you're going to see within that some shades of it, whereas Earth is, it's more important to display it as kind of decadent and falling apart a little bit. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. I may be reading too much into this, but...
No, but the people who are serving from Earth in the military are only a fraction of like what that culture is versus Mars.
And yeah, Mars is all that, yeah.
Yeah.
And in a way, so is the belt. They have to be like these hard scrabble people who, you know, mine and kill, basically, because that's what you got to do.
Yeah, we've talked before about how we haven't seen as much of Earth culture. So getting to see what's happening on the Agatha King, even though it is this very specific, institutionalized, like, subsection of Earth culture is interesting. And for me, following Admiral Souther's character, and even after he's died, knowing that because he's had this like institutional commitment and loyalty and been like such a strong pillar of this world, that all these ships are willing to just take his word on something, it's really well done and reminded me a lot of Battlestar Galactica, which is always a good thing in my book.
I can't argue with that.
We do also get another look at Earth culture with the UN General Assembly and Gillis's speech and Anna's reaction to that, and a little bit more time between Anna and her wife, Nono. I do like that we get a bit more Earth culture going on there. And, that speech. Gillis's speech. That perfect pivot from we're all in this together to, but Mars has rejected that, and they're not us anymore. We have to bring them back.
Yeah, redefining we. And so these two episodes, one of the things, we don't always get the same themes over the course of two episodes that we watch for one episode of the podcast. But this idea of who is the enemy, you have to figure out who the true enemy is, just kept coming up over and over again. So it was cool to see it kind of from the opposite perspective, where we see it a lot with Bobby mentioning just figuring out who the enemy is and realizing it might not be who you think it is, to Gillis creating an enemy, I guess, that doesn't need to exist on the other side. Yeah, it was a really well-developed theme over these two episodes. Mm-hmm. A little redundant in some of the explicit dialogue, but I'm okay with it.
I mean, at the end of the previous episode, there's the shock over the explosion in the Amazon that kills 2 million people. But it's sort of treated more like a horrible defeat for the politicians there. And of course, Aaron Wright just sort of pivots and is like, well, it's his fault because he hesitated, you know. He should have been a warmonger earlier and with more commitment.
Come on, you're slacking, buddy.
But here, Nono actually gets to verbalize to Anna the fact that a 9/11 event times 100 has just happened here, and 2 million people have died, and it is devastating and traumatic. And we finally get a little bit of that. But that's Anna's role in this episode, to sort of be the one who communicates the horror of war when nobody else around her actually is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's so many questions about how everyone else in that room, that General Assembly room, felt. I don't know. I mean, obviously, we've all seen these speeches before in real life where something terrible happens and it can be used to, like, bring people together for causes that might not be the most just. But
the Iraq War springs to mind. Just one example.
For example. It felt so representative of that. And I was curious more about, like, who was in that room and how they felt about things. Yeah, again, I mean, I don't want to keep hammering home this point, like, podcast episode after podcast episode, but having Anna as the person who's like, this is still happening, this tragedy is still ongoing, but not actually understanding how Earth, a lot of the Earth, like, population and culture feels about it, or even the people in that room, is not... You know, these are two great episodes. It's not like a deal breaker. This show is doing so much. I don't know where they would even find space for that. But I am curious about what that looks like Anna.
I do like having her wife in here to just say, like, I'm just trying to keep our, like, center open and, like, the church running and, like, try not to freak our kid out too much. I agree. I do want to see more of, like, are there any politicians that doubt this? What happened to any of those protesters? I don't know. But the average person just being like, how do we continue day to day when there's a great tragedy? Even when her partner is somehow involved in influencing political things, I think having her there, not just for Anna's sake, but for the viewer's sake, is kind of interesting.
Just as a side thing, every time they go to, like, Earth is apparently full of people who are, like, living on the streets and living off of basic income or whatever. But anytime they go to one of these main characters' family or friends, they always live in some beautiful stone house that we couldn't afford now, yeah, let alone 200 years from now. And I'm always like, why do you live in such a nice place? Like, what the hell?
Yeah.
Right. And Anna's, I don't think we know what Anna's wife does, but she's apparently involved with the clinic and stuff. But yeah, Anna's a Methodist preacher. That's not a highly remunerative occupation there.
No.
Maybe it is in the future. Who knows?
I don't know.
Maybe tithing comes back. I don't know.
Although the fact that she also has this, like, past connection with Gillis, I mean, unless things have changed a lot, politicians tend to be the people who come from privilege. So it would be curious. It would be interesting. I don't know if this is mentioned in the books, like, what Anna's class background is.
Let's go back to the beginning of the episode. You know, we're big drummer fans around here. And our first episode, Reload, begins with the thrilling reclamation of the Nauvoo. And that's just hella cool looking. The drones flying in. I didn't know what they were going to be doing. And then what they're doing is physics.
And yeah, crazy physics. It looked nuts, but it's legit from what I can tell.
Yeah.
It's such pretty physics, too. Like, when I think my note when I was watching this episode was like, the drones are so pretty when they light up. Like, it looks beautiful. The entire sequence is beautiful.
Yeah, it's gorgeous. And they break into, I don't know if that's the bridge or the temple or what, but it's really neat, and they've claimed the Nauvoo, and we don't see it again for the rest of the episode or the next one. And in fact, the first episode is mostly talking.
Yeah, I said this in our notes. It looks like big things are happening, but yeah, it just kind of makes you go, hey, big things. Oh, no, now they can get away with another 40 minutes of just talking. Also, complete other side note, I was having some feelings when Dormer was walking around in a spacesuit. I don't know what that means, but I'm just saying.
It's that shot of her when she is, like, on the bridge / what you were saying, Chip.
Because she looks up at the golden whatever it is, right?
Yeah. Yeah,
the spire, yeah.
Yeah, and it's just, like, this woman from, you know, the actress actually being of indigenous heritage. She's talked about playing that as a part of her character of, like, these white, like, settlers. And it's just, like, she's standing on the altar looking incredible. And I'm just like, I love this.
She's just a bad mofo is what
great.
She is.
Yeah.
She is. She walks around like she's got a destiny.
Yeah. Well, she's like, now yeah, I own this. I'm here. This is mine now. Mine and the belts.
We can only wonder what's going to happen with that next. Another thing that I really wanted to talk about in Reload was not just Ensign Sinipoli, you know. I mean, he's fun to watch, but the whole Marine subplot and their attempt to take over. And there he is just, I don't know, is he reasonable or is he tedious or what? I don't know, but there is just something so pure about this guy trying to do his best and then realizing how outclassed he is immediately.
And he really is.
So outclassed.
That's recon gear. Lofty, she could force feed you that gun if she wanted to.
I prefer it didn't come to that.
That is the drama, basically, for otherwise the pretty talky episode of Reload. And I wondered what y'all thought of that.
I mean, I'm into it because it's just such a good barometer of where all these various characters are in terms of loyalty. you know, bringing in some characters that are very much still, like, buying a company line, to see all these other characters who, you know, when SM Babyface goes and tells Carino what he saw, they're just, she and the other, you know, Cylon, are just like, that sounds ridiculous. This, like, configuration of people, this doesn't sound like a real thing. Sometimes, you know, we as viewers maybe feel that when characters from various storylines first get together, but I think it's easy to lose that sense. So bringing in, like, fresh characters to be like, wait, what's happening here? It just kind of reintroduces you to the wonder that is the Rossi.
And that wonder brings us to that point when Holden and Bobby are like, there's someone we want you to meet. And Christian walks in and he's like, what the hell am I seeing here? And that's
look
a nice
point of view.
That's a nice moment for us, too, because we're at the point finally in the show where basically all of our major characters, the ones that we love so much, are all on the same ship. And they're getting along.
Yeah, they're all on the same side. And there's a new side for them to, or whatever, for them to be against. There aren't any of them that are, like, the new people on the ship anymore.
And I think part of them acknowledging with this Martian character being like, this is ridiculous. But, like, they acknowledge that, but it also feels like the fact that all of them ended up on the same side and in the same ship feels like, of course that happened. It doesn't feel totally forced. I mean, it probably is a little bit, if you really sat and thought about, like, how big spaces they would all end up together. But I buy it because they've earned it. You know?
And that gets us to that wonderful point in Triple Point where they're on the verge of descending to Io to rescue Praxis Kid and to collect the proto molecule for Earth, although I'm sure a piece of Holden still wants to just nuke it. But they're all strapping in. Christian in a Razorback racing suit, sitting side by side with Naomi. Bobby in that killer shot of her in her power armor just magnetizing herself to the bulkhead. She doesn't need a chair. She doesn't need a seat belt.
Nope.
It gives me the same good feelings that I had when Miller showed up on the Rossi in early season two, you know, the family getting together. This is my jam. I mean, I depend so much in my fandom communities on my friends who watch my same shows with me, you know, getting together. It's a convention. It's a con on the Rossi.
That might be a bit of a stretch.
Aw, I think it's nice.
Warren, how dare you dismiss my rampant sentimentality?
Well, you know, that's what I'm here for.
They're eating some sort of terrible food that they're, like, willing to put up with because they're all together. Whatever the, like, what is it, red kibble that Naomi made?
Yeah, the lasagna's long since gone, right?
Yeah.
Red kibble reminded me of when I went to Egypt, there's something called koshery, which sounds like much the same thing. It's like lentils and mush, but it's very tasty. So
I know it. Yeah, I know. My housemates lived in Egypt for a while, so I've had that.
Yeah, so koshery is a staple, yeah.
Yeah.
I like this idea.
That's what I immediately thought of.
I like this idea of a con, though, and I'm trying to think what they're all a fan of, and I think it's, like, doing the right thing.
Well, that's a new one for Christian.
I know. Well, she has her speech in one of these episodes about, you know, how she used to just be all about Earth first and how her own understanding of where her power is best served has changed.
Which is the mirror image of Gillis's speech.
Yeah, it is interesting to think about them as two characters who maybe started a lot closer together than we as viewers and fans of Christian Avasarala would like to think, and how, you know, they diverged and went on very different paths. Maybe that's not true, but thinking again about where they both started in the first episode, yeah, Christian's gone on a journey.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Another character who's gone on a journey is Prax, and these episodes are... You know, Prax is looking much darker. He's had the chance to see Strickland's sales pitch video. Get the new model, Protomolecule Hybrid. Come on down. And he knows what they could be doing or could have done to May at this point. And these episodes are trying to sell us on the idea that he's lost some of his humanity in this surge. And do we buy it? Do we buy Prax practicing his pistolry and slapping a magazine in and just pulling down the frozen body without caring on the Martian ship and stuff like that?
No.
I mean, I kind of do. I don't think he'd be that good at it that quick, but...
Yeah, I buy that he is trying to be that person. Like, he feels like he maybe needs to be that person.
Like, he's psyching himself up.
Yeah, he's psyching himself up. But I don't think that, like, his heart is really... He's really changing. Although, Wes Chatham is really trying to sell it with his, like, glances at Prax whenever Prax says something like, you know, I could get revenge or whatever. But... Yeah, I don't.
I do ship him, though.
Let me too.
Let me put it that way. Those two, I do ship him.
Oh, yeah. I was thinking, I was like, maybe for our, you know, when we are out of episodes, I could try to read everything on Archive of Our Own that ships those two, because it's a very small amount of fic, and report back.
Jim will be our researcher.
I'm trying to figure out what the portmanteau would be.
Praxis, which is a very good ship name, I think.
That's one of the better ones.
Yeah. But I think Naomi and Holden is like Nolden or something, which is just, I
not
refuse
good.
To say. Though I just said it.
Do better, AO3.
That's okay. 13 and Missy is Thissy, so there you
go. Yeah. Sometimes we just don't need to smush their names together. It's fine.
Oh.
What are you talking about? How dare you? You're going to internet jail for that comment.
Yeah.
Can I steer us away from the shipping for just a moment?
Fine, chat.
If you must.
One last check-in before we get some final thoughts and go to the spoiler zone. Our villains. By this point, our main villains are just really darn villainous. Do they have mustaches? Just like, do they have fake mustaches somewhere in their personal quarters that they just sort of pull out of a drawer somewhere and put them on when no one's looking, so just so they can twirl them?
Oh my God.
I think they've mostly earned their scumbaggery, frankly, especially Ehrenreich.
Yeah, there's a shot of Ehrenreich where he's walking away from, I guess, Anna and Gillis, and he's like sipping on his like evil straight liquor.
He's all about the evil whiskey.
Yeah, and it's just like he's in the foreground and focus of the shot, and they have abandoned all hints of nuance, which I'm actually okay with. Normally I'd be like, okay, whatever. Some people just want to watch the world burn. But for him, they just did such a good job for so many seasons that, yeah, I don't know.
And they are in the middle of a shooting war. So, mm-hmm. You know, overt villainy. I mean, God knows we are getting enough overt villainy in 2019 and we're not in a shooting war.
Yeah.
But, you know, Ehrenreich's been maneuvering to start this war for ages, it looks like, and he's gotten it, and he's just so contemptuous of Anna, and really contemptuous of Gillis, you know? He thinks he knows what he's doing, and he's calling the shots, but the contempt that he shows Anna over the speech stuff makes me loathe him all the more. But yeah. Nguyen shooting down, is that a moment that sort of defies
that was a little
believability?
I don't know if over the top's the right word, but I was like, nah, I'm not so sure about this. This seems like a bridge too far-ish.
Yeah, I think because I still don't totally understand how the hybrids as weapons, like what the selling point is, because they seem...
Yeah,
because
they're not stable.
Yeah, they seem so unfocused that it doesn't seem like a weapon worth killing for. But maybe the sales pitch is really good. I mean, I saw the commercial. It didn't seem that good. But maybe
who would make Dr. Strickland your spokesmodel? I'm just saying.
They do have that.
Also, he's always been one note, so I don't have any... Like, he's just always been that mad scientist, so...
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and it's a little hard to talk about this without going into spoiler territory, but at this point, you've got this angle on the protomolecule that it can be turned into a weapon, and that comes from all the way back into the first season. But they're also trying to figure out where it comes from and what it means. And it's like those two pieces of it are sort of working against each other. The hybrids are important to Mao and Strickland, because they can teach them more about the proto-molecule and figure out how to overcome it before whatever the proto-molecule represents just wipes out all life on Earth or whatever they're afraid of. Whatever's going to happen with those hybrids in those pods that were launched at the end of Triple Point, it's probably very military and it's probably not going to be very good. And that use for them is, that's nothing about gaining knowledge. It's about gaining power.
Mm-hmm. When we were talking about these episodes before the podcast, Jen said something in relation to the villains about how a lot of their plans are coming to fruition and kind of working out in these episodes. Mm-hmm. And it is interesting to think about their, what I guess I described as like a lack of nuance in some ways, as less about them like ethically committing, like there's some sort of change of heart or like a doubling down, and more of a, they have even more power now, and, or the illusion of power, and how, yeah, we shouldn't give too much, we shouldn't put too much focus on the idea that they were ever choosing anything different so much as they have more control, they have more power, and that's what it looks like when they don't have to pretend.
Though they have less reason to question anything. Mm. I mean, there are plenty of reasons. I mean, Aaron Wright could be like, oh, 2 million people just died. Maybe this is bad. But also, he's got his war, so, you know.
It's, yeah. So there may be some parallels between Mao's flip in these two episodes. You know, he told Strickland to shut everything down because he apparently got really attached to May, and when he saw May kick the nurse, he's like, "Oh, that's just like Julie." and up until the point when Katoa dismembers his nurse and is speaking as though he's in communication with the Venus protomolecule, and the light bulb goes on for Jean-Pierre Mao, and he's like, "You were right all along, Strickland. Let's do this thing."
This is what bugs me about just sci-fi in general. It's like whenever some highly advanced alien intelligence is involved, they just got to tear people apart for no particularly good reason. You know, it's like, did that not need to actually happen? I guess it did, because that's the protomolecule does. It takes things apart, but it just seems a little too horror movie, if that makes any sense.
Like, what if the protomolecule put people back together?
I also am just frustrated with a little bit of what seems like Mao's, like, incompetence in these episodes. And I think it's mostly because we as the viewer know a lot more than Mao does. In that he just seems like, we know so much more about the protomolecule. And maybe that makes sense. But I'm just like, at this point, you've like been studying this thing for a while now.
And presumably sunk a lot of money into
it. Yeah. And he just seems like really surprised that Katoa can communicate in a way that I was like, wouldn't he already know this? Maybe not. But
I mean,
I don't know.
If they've just been treating the previous hybrids as just pure soldiers, they went after these kids from Ganymede for a reason. Because of their particular genetic structure, and now they're getting the most out of it.
Yeah, I think I'm thinking back to, like, I can't remember what that mad scientist name is who has a name like Kotiar.
Kotazar.
But it's Kotazar, thank you. Like, he was communicating with a protomolecule. That seems like, I don't know. Mao had a lot of, like, different protomolecule experiments happening. So even if this one is not that far along, the fact that he's surprised by this surprises me. But yeah. I could go, it might actually make sense.
But 4 for 4, Nguyen, Mao, Strickland, Aaron Wright, these are some big mustache twirlers all in a row.
Still a terrible person.
Oh, yeah, they're all bad dudes.
Yeah. At this point, who's the villain you hate the most, or the one you want to hiss, you'd love to hiss the villain the most?
Mao, because he's doing the worst stuff and he's killed his daughter, basically.
Yeah, Mao, definitely.
Maybe Nguyen for me. He just, like, blew up a whole ship. Mao's pretty bad, though.
But he's more of a hard ass. He's not trying to subvert humanity and murder his family.
And actually, the thing
it.
he Yeah, what did you guys think of when, like, one of the minions tells the other minion about his backstory?
Oh, about how he was, like, at that battle.
Yeah.
He was a hero. He was a hero, and the others are just like, whoa. That was the one pointless scene in the whole episode for me, I thought. You know, this is not the time. I am not impressed by his valor under fire, and I was wondering why the others were.
I was wondering if that scene, they were, the minion was trying to be like, he's seen the enemy, so he, like, he knows what it takes. But part of me is like, is he just out for revenge for having, like, having had this happen to him in some level? He should understand the cost of war is losing your comrades. But what he's taken from that is, like, we have to just take out Mars. Not like, oh, human life being lost in war is terrible.
Hmm.
Yeah,
I don't know.
I mean, Aaron Wright and Nguyen both are clearly, you know, motivated by just outright animus toward Mars. And that comes across in the speech that he feeds Gillis, you know, Anna saying, you didn't have to be Aaron Wright's hand puppet. It's pure, I hate Mars. Mars has to die or be subjugated for me. And that is why Aaron Wright is still my least favorite, the villain I hate the most.
I mean, this is a close call. This is,
yeah, they're all terrible.
There's not a wide spectrum here.
We have all flavors of terrible people.
Of jerk.
Let's take a pause for reflection and get ready to enter the spoiler zone. Maybe hang out in the temple on the Naboo before it gets refitted for presumably some more functional purposes later on. So for those of you who haven't watched past episode 5 of season 3 and you don't want to be spoiled for the rest of season 3, it's time to board the Razorback and take off. That's the same line we used a while ago, isn't it?
Yeah.
We're just repeating ourselves. We're in a repeating time loop here.
It's time to hop in one of those protomolecule missiles. Jet off of Io.
Surf it.
You know, it was right there for you, Katie, and then I just feel like you just lost it a little bit. I'm sorry. Maybe we'll get on a repaired Martian ship and head back to the fleet. How's that?
That sounds safer. Yeah.
But we hope you'll come back next week, because we're going to be talking about episodes 6 and 7, Immolation and Delta V. Spoiler, those are important episodes. You can subscribe to A Legitimate Salvage wherever good podcasts are found, and follow us at Legit Salvage on Twitter. Everybody else who's up to speed on your expanseness, let's dive in. Okay, the first thing that I wanted to mention is that, you know, next time, you know, we tackled the season finale of season 2 and the season premiere of season 3 all in one go, and we're about to do that again. I didn't remember that this next episode is going to be it for the Earth-Mars war stuff.
I know, it makes me kind of sad. I just feel like there's so much work built into these storylines, and I think someone's talked about how the books are kind of constructed around, like, the first three being kind of a set and then the next three. So I feel like after this next episode, it's the start of another, like, massive trilogy. And so we're building again. And that's a fun place to be, but it also means that there's less of that, like, payoff beat to story beat.
The mid-season cliffhanger or whatever is going to be the protomolecule beginning to rise out of Venus, and we don't know what the hell. And then we're going to get the ring gate in episode 7.
Well, at the very tail end, yeah.
Yeah. And that, I think, is going to be really wild, because I don't know, it's the beginning of that shift. Our show is about to turn into something completely different. I mean, we're going to get Miller back, or a reasonable simulacrum thereof.
Yeah,
you know, everything's
kind of
about to change.
But then it's going to change again in season 4, from what little I've seen.
Yeah, all of our crew is going to get separated here.
Yeah, speaking of which, I mean, the arc between Holden and Naomi in these two episodes, as they're getting closer, forgiveness is happening, an apology is happening. that's great and sweet, and they're going to be together in the next episode, but then she's going to leave. And I'm trying to, you know, what? How does that change our interpretation of what's happening to them in this arc, in these two episodes?
To be honest, my memory is so terrible that I forgot she left. I knew it, but I didn't know it.
I think the first time I was so sad that she left, probably as part of that just like aversion to change in general that shifts after this next episode. But rewatching these episodes, and, you know, it's starting to get better in these two, but things have been so awkward for what feels like so long. I feel like Naomi's choice is such a good one in a way that I didn't necessarily feel the first time. I just was kind of like, fine, I can live with this. But yeah, she's smart.
I also think as much as they are like reconciling in some way in this episode, she is revealing this thing of like, I kept, the reason I did this was because she has this huge secret. She's kept a ton of stuff from him. And so as much as at the end of the conversation, he's just like, oh, well, you know, I understand your reasoning. It's still, she's dropped a lot on him here. And I think it makes sense that she kind of leaves to deal with some of that too.
And she's getting more pro-Belter as the show goes on. And this, that's her leaving is kind of the apotheosis of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting that she talks about like how meeting Holden and seeing, and probably just being a part of this crew in general and seeing how passionate he is about trying to help people and Belters in particular kind of wakes her back up. Because I wasn't necessarily, I never thought of her as someone who was asleep, but yeah, that is, that almost makes me, I hadn't remembered that line and it almost makes me want to go back and watch her, the Naomi stuff again just to see, to look at it in that context. I probably won't unless like, I start a spinoff podcast that's only about the Naomi scenes.
I'm not surprised.
Because what she's kind of saying there is she gave a lot to Holden and was kind of becoming like letting someone in for the first time in a long time. But she can't totally let someone in. On this rewatch, I've been so much more into their relationship than I was the first time. Not that I didn't like it the first time, but it's been really interesting to rewatch it.
But it's easier to sort of focus on it because we already know all the big picture stuff happening around it, right?
So. Yeah.
Are we surprised that she named her son Philip?
I'm always surprised she has a son. Yeah. Week after week, it's surprising. Yeah.
I forgot that she gave this much information. All in one scene.
It's a real
scene.
info dump of all of the information about her.
Yeah.
Her backstory. She's like, listen, here's my backstory. I've known it since I auditioned for the role. I wasn't allowed to talk about it.
Oh. I did mention that, you know, everything's about to change, you know. They talk about the Katoa protomolecule hybrid, talks about the work. What did you think that they were talking about at the time, you know, before, because we all studiously avoided the books at this point. So the mystery of the work that Katoa is talking about, and they're trying to figure out the connections between the protomolecule on Venus and everything else. Did what the work turned out to be live up to your expectations of what you thought it might be at this point? Or were you just sort of in a, I have no idea what's going on kind of space?
I think whatever I thought the work was far less interesting than what it turned out to be. They really expand. Like,
ding.
It just really kind of blows up from here in this way. You know, they're like, oh, the laws of physics. We kind of hinted at the things about the protomolecule that subvert them. But after this, it just, it like dials it up to 11 in terms of that. And I don't think I ever had any clue that that was what that was going to be.
Yeah, especially having all of this come out in an episode that's so, in a season or half season that's so war-centric, and also how we're conditioned to expect certain things from military science fiction, which to a certain extent this is. Yeah, it's easy to just be like, maybe to succumb to the lowest common denominator storytelling, which is something warlike.
Which they don't do, which is nice.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The hybrids themselves, they're really scary. They're, you know, what Katoa is turning into is pretty scary. And we've been dealing with them ever since the hybrid took out Bobby's team. And after the hybrid pods get blown up next episode, no more. That's it. It's done.
Hard to believe.
And I think it's just a sign of that. It's the next phase. The protomolecule is about actually, you know, stargates and space travel and instantaneous communication and things like that. It's just, it's almost like the hybrids are, they're not just like a head fake or something like that, but they're almost like a red herring. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah.
So what happens to them? Do they turn into the gate? Do they become gate fuel? Like what's it?
No, they just get blown up. You know, the ones that have been launched are targeted at Mars and at the ships up above, and they get blown up, and that about wraps it up for the hybrids.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's very much the end of the storyline of like humans thinking they can weaponize or control the protomolecule. But it does, in some ways, feel a little clunky to me here on the rewatch to just be like, oh, man, I remember this being, like, such a cliffhanger. The hybrids are being launched. And I'm like, this doesn't really matter that much. This is just interesting.
We're also on the verge of our last episode with Prax.
Oh.
And that makes me sad.
Boo. One of my favorites of the second tier guys, I guess.
Yeah. So they've built him up to become a lot harder and a lot colder in these two episodes. And we expressed our skepticism about how much we bought that. But in the end, he gets to the point where he has Strickland at the other end of a barrel of a gun. And with Amos's help, he doesn't pull the trigger, and in the end, when we say goodbye to Prax, we're saying goodbye to May's dad, not the cold, remorseless, vengeance-driven killer who got his revenge on Strickland, you know, so.
He was never going to be that guy, let's be honest.
No.
Oh, they tried to convince us he would be. They tried so hard.
But it's just not going to.
No.
Which is fine, I'm not complaining.
I'm
just imagining if they, like, change that scene where he's watching the commercial so he's just, like, binge-watching Friends or something. And Amos is like, come on, buddy. Gotta get away from this stuff.
I'm sorry, I've got to stop this podcast and fire up Adobe Premiere right now.
I'm just saying, if they hadn't tried to, like, convince us he's gonna be some sort of revenge-seeking dude, I think this storyline would have been... Like, they could have used that space elsewhere. Or still on Amos and Prax, but in a different way.
I feel like we can't end on Kitty's, like, Prax watching Friends.
Or a better show.
I want to see that happen.
Thank you.
Well, let's wrap this up and then come back next week for Immolation and Delta V, the end of one part of another part of the saga and the beginning of the beginning of the end of the run up until we find ourselves confronting a binge load of episodes for season 4. And that's going to be so weird and so different.
Which I'm going to binge. I'm just going to binge. It's going to happen. There's no way around this.
I know. I guess we'd need to find some time on our calendars for a 13-hour podcast recording session.
Well, that seems reasonable, yes.
Well, it's also the day that Harry Styles' new album comes out. So Jen and I have a lot of tough decisions to make.
You know...
Yeah, Chip and I less so.
I'm astonished that it only took us 14 podcast episodes to get to Harry Styles, I'm just saying.
I've been holding it back.
And on that bombshell, thank you all listeners so much for joining us on A Legitimate Salvage. We'll be back next week to discuss Immolation and Delta V. Until then, this is going to be very tedious if you remain this dim. Right. The tedious version, then.